Hello and welcome back to Screen of Consciousness. It's a podversation about the films and TV shows we love. Now this week we're going to talk some film theory, which of course we always like doing every now and then. But before we discuss that, please subscribe on Anchor or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or of course Spotify. And you can find us on Twitter at Screen of C or on Facebook and Instagram at S of C Podcast. So please follow us, get in touch with us. We're always happy to hear from you, and you know, we like knowing that there's people out there actually listening.
We are very happy to know that, and we know also that you like listening to our theoretical episodes quite a lot.
Yes,
which is yes, a surprise for me. But Jonathan, is the male gaze still our highest rated, highest listened to episode?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The male gaze is our most popular episode, which is another reason why we thought we'll do another theoretical one, also about feminist film theory.
Yes, it's very interesting. And I've been looking forward to this one. Today we'll be talking about the Bechdel test, which I think is a staple, as Jonathan says, of feminist film theory. I think it's fair to say that now it's just a staple of film theory in general. It's quite yes. widely either applied or debated or talked about. Quite possibly you have never heard about it, but it is still very relevant to how we, I think about films, and certainly a lot of the discussion that have been had, you know, the last 2, 3, 5 years about representation of women on film that I think everyone is aware of. However, you know, you're into film theory or not. So, Jonathan, would you start us off by presenting to us the idea of the Bechdel test, what it is and what is meant to do?
Yes, yes, okay, I will. So the Bechdel test, it originally comes from a 1985 comic strip written by a famous cartoonist called Alison Bechdel. Now, in the comic strip, she has two characters talking about going to a film, going to the cinema, and one of them not going to the cinema because she says that she has a test that applies to films, and that's basically the films that she will watch have to pass her test. And the test that she has is that the film must have at least two women who talk to one another about something other than a man. So that's the Bechdel test originally. So I'll say it again, it's two women having a conversation with one another, and they're not talking about a man. So that's the original Bechdel test. It's also known as the Bechdel-Wallace test as well, just in case you've heard it another way. Now, this, as I said, was in 1985, and it kind of came into film theory in the 2000s. And ever since the 2000s, it's been discussed quite a lot. The test itself has changed a bit. So now, for example, some people say that the female characters have to be named characters. They can't just be random characters in the background. And also, as Dimitri was just saying to me before this podcast began, he was saying that those women have also should have a longer conversation than just one exchange back and forth. So basically, the test has kind of inspired other people to look at film theory in this way, or in a way of how women are represented and also how important the women are to the film. Now, it's a very simplistic film theory, which in a way makes it really good, and it's the reason why people talk about it, but in another way, that's why it's kind of criticised. So in this episode, we'll discuss the pros and cons of it, and also we'll discuss it in relation to the films that we love.
Indeed.
And films we may not love.
Yes, films we love, we don't, and famous films in general. I would say, yeah, so just to clarify, one of the modern iterations of the test, which I actually think is very reasonable, is that the conversation between these two women has to run at 45 seconds at least. This is just to avoid, as Jonathan was saying before, you know, to avoid this idea that there could be, we could have, you know, a serial killer film, and the serial killer works in a shop, and while his back is turned, two elderly women who are patrons say, "Good morning, Mrs. Robinson. Good morning, yeah. Good morning, Mrs. Atkinson," to each other. And that's it. You know, I don't think that's the idea of the test. So ideally, it should be a conversation with some meaning. And I think that's why some people add that these should be named characters. I guess the main idea is that to have women on film and not have them be focused on the male characters in the film, right? That's why they have to talk not about a man. Because, of course, going back to, you know, the earliest days of filmmaking, there have always been women in films, but some would argue that, you know, often women are either kind of like a mother figure or most commonly a romantic interest. And, you know, even if there's, we have the inner romantic film, for instance, you know, a rom-com or something. We're going to have the male lead and the female lead, and the female lead talks to her girlfriend, but they talk about this guy that she has just met and fallen in love with. That would be something that does not pass the Bechdel test, because probably the feminist would say, the feminist film critic would say, you know, sure, you have women talking, but it's still about a man. It's still like presenting women's lives as solely revolving around men.
Yeah. Yes. But then this is where the criticism comes in, because of course, just because, say, for example, there's a rom-com about a woman, the main character, and she talks to her female friends about a man, is that necessarily a negative thing? Does that mean that the woman, the female characters are bad? Does it mean that they're not portrayed well? Does it mean they're not developed enough? And that's where this criticism can, you know, change. And this is, some other feminist film theorists have criticized the Bechdel test for this exact reason. Before we wanted to dive in, I just wanted to give you some fun facts that I actually looked up before we did this. There was an article in 2018 by the BBC which assessed all of the Best Picture Oscar winners up until 2018 to see which films passed and which films failed. And they found that 51% of all the films that won the Best Picture Oscar failed the Bechdel test. And what's really interesting, I thought this was really funny, was that in the 1930s and in the 1990s, more of the movies passed than in the 2000s or the 2010s.
Progressive 1930s, eh?
Exactly. So when you're saying, you know, back in the old days, you know, people critical of the way that women portrayed, well, actually, in the 1930s, it seems to suggest that women had more, at least talked to each other more in films than they did in 2010.
But then I think, Jonathan, you and I have to say this, and I think you will agree quickly that we know that actually women on film were probably more interesting in the 30s, 40s, and 50s than they are now. I think we've said as much in the podcast, so I'm actually not surprised. When I think of strong female characters, you know, I think the 40s and 50s in particular just have so many, and, you know, like in Hitchcock films, we've discussed him, often the women, sometimes they're not treated very well by the story, but certainly they're still, you know, remarkable characters and they're well developed. Although probably not many Hitchcock films would pass the Bechdel test, actually.
Oh, actually, I had a look and quite a lot of them do.
Do they? Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, no, quite a lot of them do. I was surprised as well, more than you think. But I mean, even, for example, Psycho passes the test, even though...
But of course, yeah, they talk because there would be... probably in the shop, right? Our main character, Marion Crane, she has a colleague. You know, see, this is a good point. Now that I just said it, and then now I know why I said it's stupid what I just said. Because, of course, we just forget because we remember the beautiful heroines of Hitchcock's films. But there are... I'd love to delve this into this further at some point, how I think modern films lack supporting characters. Hitchcock's films do have supporting characters, and many of those are women. There will often be an elderly woman, like a mother, grandmother, auntie figure, or even like in a shop or some, or neighbor, you know, or a colleague. That's true. Actually, which I'm sure Birds must pass with flying colors.
I'm 100% sure Birds will pass. I haven't looked it up, but I'm sure Birds will pass because, you know, the main female character does talk to a lot of different female other characters.
Actually, I think an interesting film because, like, I think there's just one man in it, really, with, I mean, an important, it's mostly women film.
It is mostly women in that film. I think it's interesting as well that, I mean, I keep telling Dimitri, watch Lifeboat, which is another Hitchcock film that no one really knows about. It's a very kind of understated film, I think, because I loved Lifeboat, and Lifeboat 100%, I'm sure, passes this test because the main character is this amazing older woman and she's really bolshy, and there are other female characters in the film, and it's got nothing to do with romance whatsoever. So
when you say bolshy, do you mean she's a Bolshevik?
No, but bolshy in the English, in the way that we say bolshy, meaning kind of strong-willed, pushy. You know, she's a very kind of, she's an old-fashioned matriarchal character that we used to love having in English TV shows and films, but you just don't see them anymore.
No, that's gone, isn't it?
It's completely gone, and I've talked about this with Dimitri before, and it makes me sad because we always used to have these very strong female characters that were older. You know, usually you see them in the kind of stereotypical way. They have like curlers in their hair and rolling pins, and they chase men down the streets. I mean, that's obviously the most extreme example, but those types of older ladies were always in our shows and films, but they just disappeared now. And as you said, the supporting roles have just gone.
And can I just say one thing? Sorry, before we jump in, because soon I think we'll start with examples. Yeah. I was thinking about this, and I think it's important to make it, like, you know, a preface to this whole episode, really. We will be talking mostly about English language films today, because I would bet money that this problem is more prevalent in English language films than in European films, than in Russian films, because I think we, you know, I think many films in other cultures do have, first of all, probably just more of those supporting characters, you know, that we miss now. And and I thought of this when you spoke about the older woman figure. You know, she's definitely not absent from Russian films. Russian, you know, in Russian life, the grandma is a huge figure. And in so many Russian films, there will be like either an actual grandma or like a female boss or again a neighbor or something. I really think, I mean, I don't have the facts, but maybe our listeners can contribute, especially if you're from non-English speaking countries. I would imagine that more non-English language films would pass the Bechdel test than English language.
Yeah, but I mean, I would, and this is a completely different conversation, but I would argue that maybe one of the reasons why those older women have disappeared is because we're obsessed with youth, and all of those characters are just not in films anymore. You know, once women get past a certain age, which is, we know in Hollywood is the truth, unfortunately, they just don't get cast in roles anymore.
And so men just pretend that they're young, so we have 65-year-old men acting 30-year-old spots. You know, I mean, Tom Cruise turns 60 next year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, before, once again, I'm just going to say, before we jump in, I just wanted to mention, so the two, we've had two special episodes throughout our series when we talked about two of our favourite TV shows. One is The Legend of the Sea Car, and the other one is The Simpsons. And I'd just like to say that, of course, both of them would pass this test, and they'd even pass the test in other ways, because not only are there two women who named characters who talk to each other and don't talk about men, you know, those two shows have extremely well-developed female characters, and they do interact with one another, because, you know, in The Simpsons, I was thinking to myself, okay, obviously Lisa is a child, but she does talk to Marge. But taking Lisa out of it, Marge, of course, has loads of conversations with her sisters, and they don't just talk about Homer or men.
No.
They have lots of deep conversations, which is what I thought of originally. And then Legend of the Seeker, of course, as we know, I mean, there's loads of female characters that have loads of conversations and they don't talk about men.
Kaylin and Kara would be the obvious, and they talk to each other throughout the series. But yes, in many, many episodes, they meet other women who are strong, you know, and well-developed. And yes, you're right. I guess, okay, to be fair, probably it's a bit simpler in a TV series just because you have more, you know, hours of runtime. But I still think your point stands. It's a very good point that, yeah, sometimes in unexpected places, you have better representation of women than, you know, in some films that go on and on about how, oh, look, there's a woman playing a part that would usually have been a man's part, and somehow that's a great feminist thing, and then, you know, it doesn't really change things too much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, as I said about Frozen, when we discussed the male gaze, I talked about Frozen 2 and how, you know, obviously Elsa is a woman who doesn't, she doesn't want a man. You know, she's doing other things rather than just wanting romance. Mm. But she is still, our gaze is on her. You know, we're looking at her beauty, really, aren't we? And that's what, you know, some feminists would argue is not good. So even Frozen, which does, of course, pass the Bechdel test, some feminist film theorists are still very critical of Frozen because they say, are those female characters, well, you know, good representations of women?
Well, so as they say in Life of Brian by Monty Python, there is no pleasing some.
Well, I guess this is the point, isn't it? You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a whole list. You can go online yourself and look at which films pass and which films don't pass. But I think what's really interesting is, for example, Toy Story 1 and 2 fail. The Lion King fails. All the original three Star Wars trilogy films fail.
And that's interesting. Can I just stop you? Because I think, look, no one is going to say that Toy Story 1 and 2 have particularly interesting female characters, I think. And
well, no, wait, Jessie in Toy Story 2 does get a lot of development.
Okay,
let's not forget that.
Fair. One, I think, doesn't, really. The first Toy Story doesn't have women.
Bo Peep is just a background character.
Lion King, I would say, I mean, okay, there are women in it, but, you know, they're the love interest and the mother. Pretty typical.
Yeah, that's it.
Star Wars, already, see, this is where we start entering this area where, you know, does this test make sense? Look, Star Wars, of course, is entertainment primarily for teenage boys. I mean, it was. Now it's entertainment for 50-year-old men who haven't grown. But
how rude.
Well, it's true. But I think we have to say, Princess Leia was a pretty remarkable character at that point. She is a very strong character. She's not defined as a love interest. I mean, she is a love interest, but, you know, I think she has a lot of power in her own right. She's very, well, I think you could call her Bolshe as well. You know, she's quite dominant, domineering towards the male characters. And you know, I mean, she, I think she's really well acted by Carrie Fisher. So I think But yes, there aren't a lot of other women in the film, so she has no other women to talk to. But, you know, I would still say it's not... Star Wars are not bad films for female representation in the genre and in the time they were made.
Well, I mean, this is really where... Okay, as I said, the Bechdel test is a really good way of discussing this issue. But is it the best way to see... as you said, representation of women in film and TV and even fiction, because it's used in fiction, it's used in books, it's used in plays now. It's not just used in film. Because ultimately, I mean, I looked, one of the films which I love and I've been telling Dimitri to watch for a long time is The African Queen, which stars Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart. Now, in that film, there's literally those, they are the only two main characters in the film. There's one more character in the film, I think it's a man, and he's in it for about 5 minutes and that's it. So... is it fair for us to then criticise The African Queen, even though the lead is a woman, played by Katharine Hepburn, who is a very well-developed and strong character, and then we say, well, it fails the test, but it fails the test because there's only two characters in it. And the other thing I thought was interesting when I looked this up is that Gravity, of course, starring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, only has two characters in it. It also fails the test because... there's no other woman for Sandra Bullock to talk about because she's floating in outer space.
But the whole but women were pretty much with her alone. So yeah, you can't say that this film doesn't represent women because it's... I mean, George Clooney is in it a bit, but really it's just Sandra Bullock on screen alone for most of the film. How much more can you represent women, right?
But there's not even another male character for her to interact with. So it's not even about... And this is the issue because... you know, once again, how many films do you have when you have the men talking about things that are actually interesting? Unless, of course, and this is the issue, unless, of course, you have male spaces like prisons. Because obviously the Shawshank Redemption fails the test. Because I don't even think there's a woman in the Shawshank Redemption that I can remember. I don't think there's a woman in it. Unless there's someone in the very minor role. But then does that matter, Dimitri? Like, because you love that film. So does it matter that there's no women in it?
No, and this is also where I think, as I think... at least all reasonable people will agree, you know, of course we shouldn't overuse these things, and there are just films where, you know, where there are no women because it's not appropriate to the story, you know, because films aren't made to tick boxes, at least good films. I just wanted to say, I think it's a great example of The Shawshank Redemption. I wanted to mention from our last episodes, you know, Schindler's List, which I adore, is a brilliant film. I'm pretty sure it does not pass the test because there's hardly any named women in it. I mean, there are female prisoners in a concentration camp, but you know, it's a historical film. Oscar Schindler was male. The Nazi running a concentration camp, I think it's pretty obvious, would be male. I don't think you had women, you certainly had women working in concentration camps, but you know, running it, I think that was pretty much a man's job. And you know, Stern, the character played by Ben Kingsley, well, it's a Jewish accountant. I just think it's more likely to have been a man back then, you know, not that many women were in the workforce, even, you know, I mean, before Nazism took over. So it's just, that would be absurd to kind of demand, I think, just to have like lots. And, you know, also, because of course you can game this, like so many tests, this can be gamed, and people also criticize that. So, you know, yes, Spielberg could have put in a 45-second scene of two women talking in a shop and then, you know, being shot by the Nazis or something. But, like, you know, would that have been... You know, it's easy to do, but, of course, it's not about that because...
You'd add it in for the sake of it. Yeah, I think this is one of the criticisms, actually, that modern film theorists have said. They've said, you know, that some people have just added scenes in like that just so they can say they passed the test. But as we're discussing, just, okay, you add that scene in. Does it mean that the women in the film have suddenly become good? Does it mean that the film is suddenly representing women in a positive way or in a way that's more complex? Well, no, of course it doesn't. So, exactly, as you're saying, what's the point in just throwing it in for no reason?
And I think it's also, I think let's talk about a few films that do pass the test. And, you know, I see on, because Jonathan's found this lovely list, I think it's pretty easy to Google, you know, which films pass and fail the Bechdel test. It's, by the way, it's spelled... Bechdel.
Yes, I thought when I first read it, I thought it was the Bechdel test because obviously we have bechamel sauce, and you know, in England we have so many French words in English. So to me, it's like Bechdel. You know, oh, she's French. Maybe she is French. Maybe she does pronounce it that way. I don't know, but we're saying it the Bechdel test, which I assume is how they pronounce it.
We don't. So tell us if you know for sure. One film that does pass, and I'm really happy to see it, and this is an example where the passing of the test reflects actual great women's female representation, that would be The Silence of the Lambs, because has a great, as we've discussed it on the podcast, we love that film, has a brilliant female leading part, played by Clarice Starling, played by Jodie Foster, and I think she obviously talks to the girl, Catherine, I think, who is...
The girl who's
kept
being
prisoner.
Spoiler. Hashtag spoiler. Yeah.
That's partial spoiler, I guess.
But yes, she does talk to. Yeah, and I'm sure there must be other supporting female characters, maybe. But she is in a male prison for a lot of the film, isn't she? So it's kind of difficult for her.
True, but they found that, and you know, and then there are films, as you say, with several Hitchcock films passing it because he does often have. Several and well kind of formed, well developed female characters. I want to bring in a film that I love that easily passes the test, but also I want to use it as an example of how I think the test is slightly strangely limiting, because it's Doubt, film called Doubt from 2008. It's a film based on a stage play by John Patrick Shanley, and you know, it's adapted for the screen and directed by him as well. I do love this film. I mean, I like slightly stagey films, but I think it's a really powerful... It's a drama with a lot of sort of moral conundrums. And it also, I think it can be read as a pretty symbolic representation of different things in our society. And it has just... the most incredible cast, led by Meryl Streep, with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and Viola Davis. And, of course, this film is mostly women talking to each other. But the crux of the film is, it's set in a Catholic school, and the crux is this issue of whether a male student was molested by the male priest. Even though there are scenes of women talking about other things, so as I said, easily passes the test, one of the most famous scenes, I think to many people, the most memorable scene of the film is a long, very long conversation between the nun, played by Meryl Streep, and the boy's mother, played by Viola Davis, discussing this situation, really awkward, horrible situation, and the suspicion that the nun has that this woman's child has been molested. But that whole scene is two great female actors just acting their heart out. It's super emotional and dramatic. But, you know, they do talk about this boy, Viola Davis' son. So this scene would not pass the Bechdel test. But then you would say, is that really like... Because it's, first of all, it's a child. It happens to be a male child. I think a female child could also have been abused, right? So I don't even think that's that important. But in this case, you know, a nun and the mother talking about this horrible event that may have happened to this mother's child, not passing the Bechdel test. I think that's ridiculous, because of course these are two very well developed female characters. One is the lead of the film. Meryl Streep is the lead. The other is. Maybe not. It's not. She's not the lead. She's a supporting character, but really important. And you know, they were both nominated for Academy Awards for their. Actually, all the actors in this film were nominated for Academy Awards, and I think that was well deserved. But you know, that would be ridiculous that a scene like this isn't quote good enough end quote.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that, because actually there's been lots of other tests that have been created since the Bechdel test, and I'm not going to go through them all because there's a lot of them. But one of them that I thought was really interesting was the Sphinx test, and that's actually was created by a playwright, a woman who works in theatre, and she is saying what you're saying. Basically, she kind of rejects the Bechdel test in saying it may not be that important that two women talk to each other and about something other than men. What she has is a series of questions that talk about, are the women playing an active role? Are they complex characters? Are they compelling characters? Do they take center stage? So as you're saying, all of those answers would be yes, of course, in Doubt, because all of those women have very, you know, complicated, compelling roles, and they're, you know, they're being active in the storyline. I think just going back quickly to The Shawshank Redemption, I think, you know, the Sister Act, of course, passes the test. And I think it's interesting that, you know, Sister Act does have male characters. I think there's only two or three characters that are male, but they're of course very small roles. Harvey Keitel, of course, being the villain, is kind of the main one. But I mean, we wouldn't question the fact that it's set in a convent and all the characters are female, which of course you're saying is about doubt as well. But we do question, for some reason, the films that are set in prisons, in male prisons. Because, you know, of course, when Orange is the New Black came out, you know, that's set in a female prison. No one really, obviously everyone liked that show for various reasons, but I don't think people questioned the fact that it was in a prison with only a female cast. Did anyone really care? I think that's also true for the male ones as well. Most of the time, people don't care. They just accept that that's the world. So it doesn't really matter.
No, one of my favorite films of all time doesn't pass the test. There Will Be Blood. And, you know, it's a film without women. But then
I don't remember a woman in it.
No, but then I think, and a very few people have criticized There Will Be Blood for that. And I just think that's so asinine. Because, you know, it's a film about ambition, about greed, about this kind of striving for success at any and all costs, and, you know, about pushing the kind of new frontiers, you know, literally in America 100 years ago. And you just think, well, this is very much the epitome of this kind of male experience. And if you want to talk about toxic masculinity, you know, then it's a film about toxic masculinity in, you know, in large parts.
Yeah.
I don't think you can tell the story with women. The whole point is that it's a world of men, and I think I think the film makes very clear how damaging it is to have a world without women, because these men are insane. So, I mean, some of them, they're certainly all obsessed with, you know, power and kind of devoured by their ambition. And, you know, if they had more women in their lives, I don't think they would be like that. So, you know, how is that? That's, you could say that the film is making quite a feminist point, you know, that these men have just gone too far. So you can't criticize it as being anti-feminist, I think, at least.
Yeah, no, well, let's compare, and this is a bizarre comparison, but let's compare There Will Be Blood, which fails the test, to Clueless, which passes the test. Now, could you tell Clueless from a point of view of a male characters? I'm sure you could, potentially, but I don't think it would be work as well, and I don't think it would be as popular. And I think Clueless, you know, it's about a very rich high school girl from, you know, Beverly Hills or somewhere in Los Angeles. And that film, obviously, is a remake of Emma, the Jane Austen story. But Clueless, you know, women love Clueless. It's a great film. I mean, my sisters made me watch it all the time when I was a child, so I don't really have any objective feelings about it, because I feel like I know it too well. But, you know, that is a film that has loads of women talking about, of course, most of the time they're talking about men, but they're not just talking about men. And you think, well, if those films appeal to women, then is it wrong for them to watch those films? Because all the women in that film are, of course, well-developed characters and they're well-acted. So is that a problem just because they're talking about, you know, the whole point of the film is she's a vapid high school valley girl.
So you're saying, I think you're saying, really, aren't you, that just let people enjoy what they enjoy, right? So I think, yes, men should be able to see, like, a film about some, you know, platoon in action and war made up only of men, and women should be able to watch Orange is the New Black and, you know, Clueless, and of course both men and women can watch the other films as well. But yes, I just think it's this kind of blandifying of culture, that everything has to follow the same sort of patterns or whatever. I wanted to mention a film that we both love that I don't think passes the Bechdel test. I haven't watched it and, you know, checking for this, but I just, I can only remember one female character in it.
Yeah.
But then that female character is the whole point of the film. It's Ordinary People.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, yeah, I mean, I can see
from the cast list that there's one other female, like a supporting female part, but I frankly don't remember. Maybe it's the girl
it's the girl he fancies, yeah. There's a girl who's also been in because he goes away to a mental health facility, and there's a woman who's there with him, and she comes out, and they meet up, and they have a conversation in a diner. But I don't.
And she doesn't talk with his mom, right? So I don't think that.
I don't think she talks to his mom. But you're right. I mean, I did check Ordinary People, and it did say that it's debatable whether it passes or fails. But the thing is, I mean, as we discussed in the episode when we talked about Ordinary People is about, as you said, the relationship between two men and one woman, because it's about a father and a son and the relationship with the mother, or his wife, the husband's wife. And that's the point of the film.
I actually say, it's so funny, it kind of turns the whole premise of the Bechdel test on its head, isn't it? Because that film is mostly about the father and the son dealing with the woman in their life, and they certainly talk a lot about this woman, you know.
Yes,
the dad
yes.
and the boy talk about the boy's mother, the dad's wife, all through the film, don't they? So actually, yes. That would have... It's funny to turn that around to be like, are there scenes when they don't talk about a woman? Because they spent a lot of time talking about a woman. I actually think they talk about this girl that the boy has met also. I think he talks about her with his father, doesn't he?
And the psychologist, because he has a psychologist.
And a male psychologist. And yes, even with the male psychologist, they discuss the mom and the girl. So yes, it's a film about men thinking and talking about women.
Yes, before we wrap it up, I mean, I think the Sphinx Test is an interesting way of looking at things, because I wanted to mention another film that we love and we've also discussed on this podcast, which is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Mm.
Now, it technically fails the test, even though there's two very strong main women in it. You know, there's Jessica Rabbit and there's Dolores, who is essentially, I would say that Dolores is more of a romantic lead, but she's not really, because she's kind of best friends with Eddie, the main character, rather than just being romantic. But the thing is, you know, Jessica Rabbit, okay, you can criticize the way she's looks, and ironically she says she can't help it because she's drawn that way, which is part of her character. But you know, Jessica Rabbit is a well-developed, active, complex and compelling character. She isn't just, I mean, yes, she's drawn to look like a bimbo and she's meant to be a femme fatale, but she actually does have a very important part. I mean, essentially the whole plot is about Jessica Rabbit, really, when you think about it. And yes, she's meant to be eye candy, even though she's a cartoon. But does that therefore make that film bad? Because, you know, and also Dolores' character, although she's glamorous, she's not meant to be... She's not overtly sexual, which is Jessica Rabbit is. So there's two very different types of women. And even Betty Boop, who has a supporting part, she's in it a little bit. She actually gets quite well developed, because she talks to Eddie about how she's black and white and, you know, colour cartoons have kind of taken over. She can't get work anymore. That's quite a poignant moment.
Mm.
But then I would argue with this film, the whole point of this type of film, which is kind of a film noir or a neo-noir spoof, or kind of, you know, maybe not a spoof, a pastiche, if you have a main character who's going through the film and essentially interviewing people and talking to people, I don't think two other male characters have conversations without Eddie being a part of it. I can't remember two other male characters having discussions off, you know, without him being in the scene, because he's in every single scene, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so my point is basically, I'm saying, does it necessarily matter as much if the main character, you know, who we know is leading the plot, you know, if you don't see other characters having conversations, basically, because even if a woman, as you're saying, like Gravity, she's leading the plot, because she doesn't talk to anyone else and there's no one else talking about her or talking about anyone else, does it matter?
Well, that's an open question. I would like to end
throwing
on,
it out there.
No, but I think it's a good question. I would like to defend the Bechdel test here at the end with an anecdote from my own life. I'm currently, as Jonathan knows very well, developing a science fiction television series. I was recently doing a rewrite of the draft for the pilot episode, the first episode of the series. And this is a story, it's quite a sprawling story, sort of, you know, futuristic sci-fi, a big cast of characters. It's really an ensemble piece in a way, and lots of them are female. I think it's pretty well balanced in terms of, you know, gender representation. But I thought about the Bechdel test at some point, and it struck me that I didn't think, and I checked it, I didn't really have a scene where just two women talked to each other, because there were many scenes of several people. People are on board a spaceship, and there's equal number of men and women, and they're all talking together, but there weren't really any scenes of just two women having a one-on-one. To be fair, I'm not even sure there were scenes of two men having a one-on-one, because there was a lot of scenes of men, one man and one woman talking. As Jonathan just said, you know, is that bad? I don't really think so. There's still as many women as there are men. But I think, you know, so I definitely think the Bechdel test shouldn't be applied, you know, rigorously. But I think it can serve as an inspiration, because I thought, you know, what would it take for me to have a scene, to pass the Bechdel test, to have a scene of just placing two women together and giving them a conversation, because maybe I just hadn't thought of that. And, you know, it turns out I didn't. I mean, I wasn't going to force it in just to check a box, but thinking about that gave me an idea for two female characters where I thought, oh, it would actually be really interesting to put those two together, because they're very, very different. They contrast a lot, maybe the more than with any of the male characters in my series. So I thought, yeah, what if I cram them into a room, like force them, give them a reason to be in one room, and have this like 1.5-page conversation about something, And I actually think it turned out very well. I'm very happy that I wrote that scene. It's going to stay in. Some people have commented that they really thought it was a strong scene. It worked well. So there you go. And the Bechdel test just got me thinking about that. So I think, you know, maybe that's a way to apply it, to just keep it in mind in case in case it happens to be relevant to the story you're trying to tell, then why not? But certainly not something that should be forced on new films, and I don't think it should be retroactively used to criticize old films, especially if it's just not relevant, or if it's misleading, as I just said in my example, and as Jonathan said before, what if you have several women, but you just have them interacting with men, the same way you have several men in the film interacting with women?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think with all of these things, as you've you just said, they can be very helpful, but we shouldn't ultimately just, you know, make them mean. How can I say this? We shouldn't think that we just apply them to everything, and mean that means something, because ultimately it may not mean anything. So we really have to look at these things and say, actually, there's more to it than just a very small set of rules,
but also quite a superficial one, really. I think that's also what you're saying, and many people have said it is very superficial to check. Yes, is there a 45-second interval in the film where these two women have a conversation, not about a man? It's, you know, out of a 3-hour runtime for a film, maybe it's a kind of, you know, just random.
Yeah, and does it help if you did, as we said before, if you throw it in there, and then you turn around and say, oh, well, it's in, so it's fine, it passes the test. Well, that actually hasn't solved anything, then, has it, really, if you've just crammed it in for no reason, and the rest of the female characters are just rubbish anyway, so it doesn't really help. Which, as we've already discussed many times on this podcast, I think that we both agree that female characters generally today are fairly weak, I would say, in most kind of modern Western cinema, and TV shows, I would argue, as well, actually. But anyway, it's been a really interesting discussion. I think if you'd want to talk to us more about it, then please, get in touch with us on Twitter at Screen of C, or on Facebook or Instagram at S of C Podcast, and just let us know what you think, because there's so much more to talk about with this. So,
please do. I think this would be so interesting. If you just try to think of your favorite film, or two or three of your favorite films, and think of whether the Bechdel test applies, and then, you know, whether or not it makes sense, because I think we had examples both ways of some films where, like Gravity, it's strange, you're surprised that it doesn't apply, and then there's also some, especially modern action films, where I do think they just crowbar it in, so they do check the Bechdel test box, but they still have terrible female characters, as Jonathan says. So I think it's kind of funny, like check what films you love, you know, how they fare on this question, and especially maybe to our, as we said, non-English language listeners, is it different in your culture? Like, maybe this is not such a, you know, maybe there are fewer films that don't pass the test in Eastern European cinema, perhaps in Asian cinema, in French cinema. I kind of feel that there's a lot of women usually in French films.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's another great talk, Dimitri. So we will be back next week. So we look forward to you listening to us then.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you for listening, and bye bye.